Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we're going to be talking with Dr. Matt Morrow, chair of UNC Radiology, about radiation and safety. And I know, I'm sure, that you have as many patients as I do who are concerned about the risks of having lots of x-rays and CAT scans. And I'm looking forward to having a conversation about that with a specialist in the field.
Yeah, not only patients, I have questions.
I do,
you know,
too.
It's the sort
hard.
Of thing that I get asked, and I don't always know all these answers, and I have to really go look them up, and it's a little confusing sometimes. And then all the stuff that happened in Japan and the nuclear reactors melting down and all that radiation release and safety, I mean, it just raises so many questions. So I think this will be a great opportunity for us to get some things out there, find out what we know and don't know. And speaking of what we don't know and know, we have some really interesting research that matters this week, Christy, about losing weight via the internet.
About irritable bowel syndrome and yoga and meditation.
Which we all could use some yoga.
No, I need some.
About, I've got glasses and being nearsighted, do I have to worry about glaucoma?
And about children who talk a little later than their peers and how they do as they grow up.
Were you a late talker?
My family says I was very quiet because my sisters were so talkative.
Oh, and see here, my family said I didn't quit talking. We got both ends of the spectrum. Well, let's talk about our very first research article, Christy, about the internet and losing weight. And, we have just thousands of patients each year and millions across the U.S. who really do need to lose weight. The question is, we've presented a lot of kind of negative studies here, things that don't work. So here's the question is, does the internet help you lose weight if you follow internet protocols?
Well, and Adam, I read that question, can the internet help you lose weight? And I wrote beside it, yes, because I lost 19 pounds doing Weight Watchers only online. But this is a study really looking at, it's one of those reviews that we talk about, Adam, where they look
systematic
at
systematic reviews or meta-analyses, those sorts of reviews,
they
right?
They looked at 23 different studies that compared weight loss programs that had an internet component compared with those who didn't have any online support.
Yeah, and this research actually published in the International Journal of Obesity found that if you actually had an internet program that was combined with some sort of really in-person counseling, you actually had 2 pounds lighter compared to those who didn't have that internet component. If you didn't have that in-person counseling, they seemed to think that that needed kind of like maybe the boost to get you started, but that the internet program really was important to maintaining and losing that weight.
Yeah, and there are lots of programs that have both internet and in-person counseling, and it sounds like those types of programs are the most successful, at least within a modest couple pounds, but that's significant to a lot of people.
Yeah, and I guess the real question will be, what does it cost, if you can take an internet program for free versus it costs? Does this make a difference, and how long is it, and how much support do you get? There's a lot of questions here, I think, so I wouldn't just encourage you to take any internet program that you see out there, but it sounds like you were successful in one in particular.
In Weight Watchers, and actually so many nurses and staff in our building are on Weight Watchers now, and it's amazing.
Let's be honest, Christy is not a paid consultant for Weight Watchers.
They should be, but I love it because
if you look like her and it worked, you should definitely take it. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, Christy. And this is, I've got so many patients, even family members, that have irritable bowel syndrome. And, they recommend, a lot of the experts recommend drugs, and those are okay, but a lot of the drugs have side effects too. So here, I love this article that talks about, does mindfulness or yoga help irritable bowel syndrome?
I love this study, Adam, because we do know, and we've talked before on the show, about cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a type of counseling and therapy that helps you change your thinking patterns and how they link to how your body feels. So we know there's a mind-body connection with irritable bowel syndrome, but this is something even easier to me than that and safe. Meditation, yoga, Very exciting.
And I think we even looked into this, that this was helpful with people with fibromyalgia, a recent research study. And here is one that was looking at irritable bowel syndrome. And actually, this was actually done here at the University of North Carolina.
UNC.
We have one of the top three centers in the world for irritable bowel syndrome and particularly mindfulness issues. And they took 75 women who either underwent this mindfulness therapy randomized, or the other group they went to was a support group, and they followed these people for 3 months.
And it's nice study design because both groups thought expected to get better, and both groups did get better. But the group who did the mindfulness meditation and gentle yoga really improved on a scale of 100 questions that they ask about irritable bowel syndrome, improved by 100 points compared with only 30 points in the support group.
Right. So, and as a expected, this is something that could be recommended for a lot of people because it is safe. I think, you know, there are some questions about, you know, this is not a free therapy for a lot of people. They would have to spend money. And in this particular study, it was free for them.
Right.
So what would happen if you go out and have to spend, you know, a couple $100? But on the other hand, there's not many side effects.
No, I mean, really, it's totally safe. So I'm supportive of it, and we'll explore it with patients who have irritable bowel syndrome from this study.
Yep. And our next research, I've got glasses, Christy, and it seems like everyone in my family has glasses, so there's something genetic going on here. And, you know, it always wonders, how often do I have to get eye exams, and does it really matter? And I've always been a little bit ambivalent, not that I don't like to get eye exams, but I don't really know, do I really continuously need them?
Well, and then when you go for an eye check, do you really need to get your eyes dilated and get the full-blown test? But this is...
The eye doctors have the coolest instruments of any doctors. They've got like 15, and you get to see all these floating things and colors.
Well,
I love them.
They said I could do the test for glaucoma and, you know, looking for, you know, other problems in the back of your eye without having the dilated but I'd have to pay $50 out of pocket.
And I said, didn't do it.
No, I said no, and don't dilate my eyes. But this is about glaucoma and a potential link between nearsightedness and developing glaucoma.
Right. And so, you know, glaucoma can cause blindness. It can really cause deterioration of vision. And it's a serious condition of aging for a lot of people. And so if you're at higher risk, in this study that was published in the journal Ophthalmology, and again, a kind of a systematic review of 11 other studies looking at thousands of people, showed that people who are nearsighted, like me, have difficulty seeing things far away, were 90% more likely to develop open-angle glaucoma, the most common type of glaucoma.
And at this point, it's recommended that you get a full eye exam after you turn the age of 40.
Well, that's the American Academy of Ophthalmology.
Right.
But, you know, this is the U.S. Preventive Medicine Services, which is the gold standard that Christy loves here. They say there's not enough evidence for or against to recommend it, but I think most of us say it's not a bad idea. It doesn't really hurt people to have an annual eye exam.
No, the dilation part is more of an inconvenience.
So I think probably we're kind of more leaning towards this now. I would be. What about you?
I think if you're nearsighted and you're over the age of 40, then it's reasonable to get it done.
Okay, well, let's talk about our very last study, which is about talking in children.
I love this because I have a lot of patients, a lot of parents who are concerned,
children.
And I have children.
Are they talking?
Oh man, they're talkers.
they
no problem
talkers.
There. No.
Okay.
But a lot of my parents are concerned about their children maybe talking not quite as many words at age 2 as their peers, and this is a study looking to see what happens when you follow these 2-year-olds who maybe don't have as many words in the lower 15% compared with their peers. When you follow them over their lives, do they have any differences in their abilities and their mental health and their behavior, et cetera?
Right. In the journal Appropriate Pediatrics, these 1,400 2-year-olds that were followed, basically by the time they got to be 5 years old, the great majority of them were talking normally. And the thing that they say, which actually really makes sense, is some of the behavioral things we see when these 2 and 3-year-olds come into the doctor and they appear to be anxious and other issues. They're anxious because people are expecting them to talk and maybe they're not ready to talk.
Or they're frustrated because they can't do
it. Frustrated. And that goes away when they start to talk. And by 5, the great majority of these kids. So I think that's reassuring for lots of parents. If there's no other red flags that you don't have to go this full speech development evaluation for a lot of these two-year-olds.
Right, especially, as you said, if everything else developmentally is on track. So that is reassuring news. We've had a chance to talk about talking and good news about, you know, slower talkers, about nearsightedness being linked to glaucoma.
About going on the internet and maybe really using an internet-based program to help you lose weight in addition to in-person counseling.
And talking about meditation and yoga for irritable bowel syndrome. Good articles today,
we'll
Adam.
We'll have to come up with a mantra, but this is really going to conclude what we can do on the Research That Matters portion of our show. And we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Matt Morrow about radiation and safety. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking with the chair of the University of North Carolina Department of Radiology, Dr. Matt Morrow, about radiation and safety. And this is a topic that Christy and I are really, really interested in, not just because I guess radiation safety has been so much in the news with the accident in the nuclear power plants in Japan, but just because we get questions all the time in routine clinical care about the safety of procedures, and radiology is so central to the diagnosis of so many diseases.
Before we get started jumping into that, Dr. Morrow, and thank you so much for being
with us.
Welcome
to our show.
Glad to be here.
Tell us a bit about how you became passionate about radiology. I mean, clearly you're passionate. You're on the board of the American Board of Radiology and have all kinds of amazing titles in your past. But how did you become so passionate about it and become a leader in your field?
Well, my interest in radiology began as a medical student when I was originally interested in going into general surgery. But I was at an institution that really just began the development of CT, CAT scanning, or computerized tomography, which was a way of looking inside the body without operating. And it really started to fascinate me. That combined with the then burgeoning development of interventional radiology and the combination of it got me interested in it.
And when you say interventional radiology, describe for our listeners, what do you really mean when you're talking about that term?
So interventional radiology is a relatively new field, maybe 20 or 25 years old, which is really the combination of combining imaging with our ability to place devices within the body using imaging as guidance. So historically, for us to do things to treat patients, for example, relieving blockages or draining abscesses, historically we'd have to cut them open and do those things. Now we can do those through small incisions in the skin using imaging as guidance, as opposed to using our visual sight.
Well, you know, I'm thinking back to some of the movies that I've seen and then some of the reading that I've also done. This whole question about, let's just dive right in here, about the safety in radiology. I imagine it goes back to the founding of the field of radiology, where the first time you had the ability to have x-rays to see and diagnose diseases, people maybe didn't know at that time, but there were safety concerns then as well, weren't there?
Well, 1895 is when Rankin performed the first radiograph of a human being. If you remember, it was his wife. I'm sure he didn't want to x-ray his own hand, so he chose his wife to x-ray. And again, and that was a Nobel Prize winning event, a major event in medical practice. But in the early years, a lot of people were using x-rays. They didn't know about the radiation risks. But they subsequently found out that there are risks for continuing fluoroscopy. They had little x-ray booths in your shoe stores, probably earlier than our age, where people would put their feet in their shoes and stick it under a fluoroscope and wiggle their toes to be sure there was ample room. And then you could fluoroscope someone's chest in the drugstore. Obviously now,
because it was so novel, it was like
it was kind of cool to see your toes wiggle, the bones wiggle within your shoe. But
so
now we know.
When did we first start really becoming more alarmed about the potential risk of radiology?
Really, it wasn't until the 50s. And again, this is just with fluoroscopy and conventional x-rays, chest x-rays and abdominal x-rays, that we knew that excessive doses, you can get skin changes. And ultimately, with really high doses, you can even get cancers that were forming on people's feet and hands for those people who were involved in the x-ray industry.
And over time, we've developed new technology. You mentioned CAT scans and other forms of radiology tests that also have radiation. Can you help us a little bit understand the the history of when those came, but how the radiation of those compare with the x-rays that were done back in the 50s?
Sure. So the conventional films, which are chest x-rays and abdominal films and films of your extremities, which are still used in thousands of physician offices and in hospitals across the country, those are used in conventional x-ray tubes, and it's a cone beam. So when the x-rays are emitted from the cathode-ray x-ray tube, it looks like a cone. And that's great. So CT is a technology where they use a fan beam. So they have tight collimation. So instead of the x-ray beams looking in as a cone, they're tightly collimated, so they only irradiate a thin slice of the body.
But they do lots of slices, right?
But they have to do continuous slices to go over a certain length of the body, whether it's the chest, the abdomen, or the pelvis, or all three. So you're using the same x-rays that are generated by the same type of tube. It's collimated, but the cumulative dose of the x-rays is higher than a chest x-ray.
So let's talk about the risk of x-rays, whether it's a chest x-ray or a CAT scan. And in the terms of how the public and even as us as primary care doctors, and how do we think about and how do you describe what radiation is and what the doses are in standard tests for which the diagnosis is clearly dependent upon these films frequently.
Right. And as you said before in the introduction, imaging with diagnostic x-rays is a important component of modern medicine. It's an integral component of many establishing the diagnoses of many diseases and even following the course of therapy in many diseases. So we need to know a lot about it. And we are getting to know much more about the risks of radiation and the impact on large groups of patients, large populations. Chest x-rays, which is often used as the standard, it's still the most common type of film, has minimal radiation. So let me give you an idea. So yep. We measure radiation dose, particularly the effective dose, in terminology called sieverts. And the
S-I-E-V-E-R-T.
T-S,
right?
Yeah,
oh, sieverts. Yes, good Scrabble
right,
word,
right,
seven letters.
Right, sieverts. That's the effective dose of radiation, the way it imparts on the body. Now, a chest x-ray is about 0.1 millisieverts.
A thousandth of a sievert.
A thousandth of a sievert, very small dose. However, a conventional CT of the abdomen may be on the order of 7 to 10 millisieverts.
So that would be order of magnitude higher.
Right. So it is order of magnitude higher than a chest x-ray. Now, let me give you an idea. Background radiation. Now,
that we get when we're walking,
talking, living in Chapel Hill.
Or walking in our basement.
Right. Well,
okay.
Exactly. Just living in Chapel Hill is on the order of 3 to 4 millisieverts. It's due to cosmic.
Over the course of a year.
That's over a year.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Over a year, 3 to 4 millisieverts everyone gets in North Carolina by the fact of we have a little bit of cosmic radiation. Radon gas is actually the largest component of natural radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Some parts in the country, over the Rockies, cosmic radiation is much higher. They get a little bit more, so there's always a little bit
of
radiation.
What do authorities consider safe, or is there no safe? You know, how do we understand?
Well,
that?
This is negligible. The 3 to 4 millisieverts, or the 0.1 millisievert of a chest X-ray, has minimal effect on people. Now, if you keep adding it up. There is a point where it becomes significant. We can talk about when do we start worrying about the risks and in what magnitude the risks are. But radiation is all around us.
Well, before, and we'll talk about sort of as you think about a child or a person's life as we're making these decisions about doing more tests to people. But when do you have a number of like at a certain over your life, if you reach X number of millisieverts of exposure, that really significantly increases your risk for cancer or other problems?
Well, it's interesting. They try to actually calculate the risks of cancer. That's one of the big things that people talk about, the risks of cancer with radiation. And they were using data from the Hiroshima Nagasaki event. They were trying to use data from the Three Mile Island event. Mm-hmm. They were using data from Chernobyl. It was recently stimulated because of the recent Fukushima event in northern Japan. And it's hard to really transfer those types of radiation exposures to what diagnostic imaging is. But let me give you an example of their attempt. It's been said that for moderate exposures, let's say a CT scan that gives 10 millisieverts. That's a regular abdominal pelvic CT scan that we do 100 times in the hospital every day. The risk that we're talking about is probably 0.05% of increased risk of cancer. Now, what does that mean? That's a hard number to get around. 0.05%.
So a 20th of 1%.
Right, a 20th of 1%. So that means that if you get a CT and get 10 millisieverts of radiation, your chances of getting cancer from that over your lifetime is 0.05%. But your chances of getting having no cancer from that exposure is 99.95%. Just
Great.
Think about that. 99.95% of not getting cancer and 0.05% of getting cancer. So it's still a pretty small amount, but we still need to be watchful of it.
So if you had 15, just to put it in perspective, if you had 15 CAT scans because you had a condition, perhaps lupus of the lungs or pulmonary fibrosis that required you to get these on a regular basis, you might have over a 10-year period a 1% increased risk.
Right. You can accumulate it such as that. Now, the interesting thing is for cancer, there are two types of effects of radiation to the body. So one's called stochastic effects and one's called deterministic effects. So stochastic effects is the incidence of the radiation to the body, and it causes usually some DNA damage. The increased dose increases the frequency, but it has no impact on the severity of the disease. As opposed to the deterministic effects are things like skin erythema, cataracts that you've probably heard about. That is the type of impact of radiation where the increasing dose does increase the severity of the disease and the increased frequency of getting it.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but I think when we come back, we really want to pick up on some idea of not only the risk, but also people's perceptions of risk, because
right.
I think that drives so much of what happens. We're having a wonderful conversation with Dr. Matt Morrow about radiation and safety. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Wilson and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Matt Morrow, who's chair of the UNC Radiology, about radiation and safety. And we've been having a fascinating conversation trying to understand what really the effects and the magnitude of radiation is from routine CAT scans and from x-rays. And Dr. Morrow, we've talked about this, you hear it about it in the news. What is your experience with patients' perceptions about radiation from medical procedures versus what we are afraid about with Japan and other catastrophes?
Well, I think that's a great question, particularly of the recent events at the Fukushima nuclear power plant, because clearly there's a lot more that people are hearing about radiation in the news. And there's a different types of radiation that gets that you receive from the nuclear power plant disasters than diagnostic radiation, but there are overlaps. In the Fukushima plant, for example, when there was inadequate cooling and there was an explosion, there are three types of radiation exposures that you can get from a reactor incident, and we've had one here in America.
And those are the gamma radiation?
Well, the three types of radiation is your immediate proximity, which is whole body radiation.
Okay.
That usually involves the people who are right there.
Yep.
Then the secondary types of external radiation, where the particles are landing on your skin, for example. And then the third is the internal type of radiation, where particles land or contaminate your drinking water, or they're in your
or the milk that we heard
or
was
your
widely
milk,
contaminated,
or maybe your plants, and you're actually ingesting it.
And each one can have its own level of severity.
Right. So the external radiation predominantly impacts the skin, and that's because most of the impact from a power plant is with I-131.
And
Iodine-131. As a matter of fact, we actually use that intentionally to treat thyroid cancers, but I-131. And that can have either a combination of beta particles or beta radiation. They're relatively large particles with respect to molecular concepts.
Yes.
And they penetrate very, very little tissue. So they're usually skin type of issues. And the others are gamma radiation, which is on the same par as conventional diagnostic x-rays, and they get a little more deeper. But with nuclear power plant disasters, the one that we've really studied quite a bit is Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And Three Mile Island, which happened in Pennsylvania, there was very good protective structures, and really there was no increased incidence of cancer-related deaths related to Three Mile Island.
With really good studies, actually. And I looked at this recently because I was surprised, even myself, you know, thinking that, oh, there probably have been some long-term cancers, but there really were not.
Right. Now, that
could have been, but there weren't.
But the Chernobyl and the Ukraine, the structure were markedly different. The exposures were much greater. And there, the predominant cancer was in childhood thyroid cancer because of the I-131. The kids were ingesting the I-131. Not only were they kids, which are more susceptible for cancer, they were ingesting it. And as you know, the thyroid concentrates the iodine. So the thyroids were getting a concentrated dose of this I-131, and there was a significant increase of thyroid cancers. But it's hard to correlate that with a direct correlation with diagnostic imaging.
Well, you're getting a bad name by proxy. But I assume that you are getting questions as the chair of radiology and your colleagues around the country. And yet it seems as if the relative doses that you're getting and the ways to try to improve safety don't compare.
Well, that's true, but we still have to take this very, very seriously. As a matter of fact, now all diagnostic imaging in the United States works under the ALARA principle, A-L-A-R-A, as low as reasonably acceptable.
Okay.
Meaning that if you don't need to have a study using diagnostic radiation, don't have it. If you need to have a study using diagnostic radiation, do it in such a way that you minimize dose.
Well, I wonder, I mean, it seems like however many years ago, and granted, I'm young in the medical community, but, you know, even just in medical school and coming out that so much about people wanting full body CAT scans just for screening purposes. And so some studies saying, would you take $1,000 or a full body CAT scan? And more people chose the full body CAT scan. This wanting more tests and our culture medically wanting more tests because we have them available. And now that there's some studies about risk and these nuclear explosions happening, I wonder how that's changing both the patient expectations and the conversations you have to have.
Well, we're certainly getting more questions about radiation. Does this test involve radiation when they come down? How much radiation do we get? What's the impact of this radiation? Do I really need this test? And I think those are great questions for patients to have. I mean, the tests that are being requested should be requested for good diagnostic reasons, and the majority of them are.
Well, let's talk about one common test, mammograms. And are we looking at the same dosing on mammograms today as it was 10 years ago, while the recommendations are also changing today that potentially you might be able to have it less frequently?
Right. So mammography is one example where there's been improvement in the technology so that the radiation doses per study are decreased. So that now falls in a very low dose where the risk of cancer is in the negligible. It's in that chest x-ray type of dose. It's really negligible. The culprit in diagnostic imaging is what Christy talked about, is CT. The volume of CT has markedly and exponentially increased over the last decade.
So why aren't we doing MRIs for everyone since wouldn't there be less risk?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. Number one, the availability of CT is still markedly higher than it is in MR. Two, CTs are often easier to get. There are now any new emergency room that's being built in the United States has a CT either in it or adjacent to it because it's so heavily and commonly used. At UNC, as a matter of fact, I just installed our newest MR unit next to the emergency room so we can somehow curtail that practice. In other words, start using more ER-generated MR studies versus CT.
And will the cost, do you think, of MR come down to make that, to offset?
Unlikely. the cost of medical imaging, that's another conversation.
So if I'm a patient coming in and I, what are three questions that you would encourage patients, whether they're at UNC or any other doctor's office, what are three questions that would be good ones for them to ask about potentially having a CAT scan or chest X-ray or any procedure that would involve radiation?
I think for any test, particularly one that has some potential downside or implications, one, do I really need the test? And a lot of that is up to the attending physician's perception that this may establish the diagnosis, and in many cases it will. Number two, is it being done properly? That actually is an important second question. There are many ways of performing these tests where we can minimize dose. So we've all heard about...
Give me an example.
Well, for example, you've heard about the Cedars-Sinai incident doing the perfusion CAT scans. That was a big... It was highlighted in the New York Times, and they were using incredibly high, 100 millisieverts of doses, 10 times, 20 times higher than a conventional CT needed to be, because they had some of the factors that are involved in performing the CT. Not every CT is done in the same way. We as the radiologists overseeing those, select the appropriate kilovoltage, mass or milliamperage, the timing, the pitch of the scanner, the way the table couches in. And there are ways now of doing that with minimal radiation.
So patients should ask, do I really need this, and try to understand that, and is this being done properly to minimize
right.
the risk?
Is this being done and supervised by a diagnostic radiologist? And for example, we have a nationwide campaign called Image Gently, particularly for pediatrics. Right, so everyone is reevaluating their CT protocols to minimize dose. Still obtain diagnostic quality scans, but minimize dose. It's amazing the changes in the doses that can occur with attention to that detail.
We're going to have to wrap up, but if I encourage our listeners, they'd like to hear a little bit more about our conversation with Dr. Matt Maher about radiation and safety and maybe the future of radiology. Listen to Behind the Scenes. We'll have a little bit more of our continuing a dialogue. But thank you, Dr. Maher, for taking time out and talking with us. This is a really important. I know it's something that we deal with every day.
Thank you, Dr. Maher.
Thank you for being. Pleasure being here.
Coming up on House Calls, we're going to be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. Christy, that was a really interesting segment. I think we should do some more things about radiology and radiation and X-rays. I think this is something interesting and people really want to hear more about.
It is an important conversation, and we're grateful to have had it today. Now we've got some house calls, which is when our listeners write us or call us with questions, and we have a chance to talk about those health questions and concerns on the radio.
Yep. You can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also go to Twitter, and you can also send us on Facebook. Lots of different ways of letting us know. And what's our very first house call that we're going to talk about today?
Let's listen to it.
Hi. I started B12 supplemental shots several months ago and noticed that my face started breaking out. Went off of the shots and started the pill supplements and have continued to experience this breakout. Wondering if there's any correlation between or association between vitamin B supplementation and adult acne.
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, B12 shots in and of themselves are interesting. It used to be when I was coming through residency back in the dark ages, Christy, there were a lot of people getting B12 shots. And then it seemed to fall out of favor. And so you rare, unless you really have a true B12 deficiency, do you see many people getting B12 shots today?
Yeah, and I still have some patients who come to me on B12, and you really have to ask the question, why are you taking this, and what was that about? Because many people who are taking these shots don't necessarily need them.
Oral medicines don't really work. You don't absorb it. So if you are truly B12 deficient, what happens to a lot of people is they get a blood level drawn as a workup for something, mm-hmm. and they get kind of a borderline low value, and so people get told you maybe have a borderline low B12 shot, and you start taking the shots, and do you feel better? Well, a lot of people, when they get a shot, feel better. But in this particular circumstance, it sounds like our listener may be having side effects. And here, acne is not something I'd heard about, but you found some interesting research.
Yeah, people, you know, I didn't know about a link between B12 and acne, but apparently there is a link that, and women are more affected by this than men, but getting B12 shots or B6 or taking B6 supplements can make acne worse or make you break out with acne, even if you didn't have it before.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I think Christy and I will both probably agree on this one. You know, you may want to talk with your doctor about whether or not you really need those B12 shots and maybe stopping it for a while and see if it goes away, because it should go away if it's due to the B12 shots. If you do need them and you've got the acne, well, that's a whole different ballgame, and probably you're going to really need to come in again and see your doctor. You might even need to see a specialist, but you may need to treat the acne, because that's tough. But there are also other things other than quote-unquote acne, things like rosacea, mm-hmm. other conditions that can simulate acne. So if it doesn't get better about stopping it, what do you think, Christy?
Well, I mean, I think that's, I would go into your doctor, the one who's giving you these B12 shots, to show him or her your face and kind of go through and make sure that you're dealing with the right thing and make a plan from there. But that may be going for a trial without the B12, like you're saying, make sure the diagnosis is right, and then treating acne if it's breaking out on its own.
Okay, well, let's take a listen to our next house call today about someone wondering why their family members didn't get treatment at an early time.
My aunt was just diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, and I'm just wondering, why didn't she know earlier before it hit that stage, and why didn't she want to go to the doctor? It's always been a persistent problem in that side of my family that they don't like to go to the doctor to get checkups or just to get regular screenings, and I want to know what is preventing them from seeking medical advice or going to the doctor, and why are they so against going to the doctor on a regular basis?
Wow, thank you for sharing that situation. And, you know, our hearts certainly go out to your aunt. And, gosh, it makes me sad to hear that, because I think as a medical community, we have not done a great job over the years of really engendering trust and helping people come in for their early screenings. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I don't know if we fully... I don't want to take all the blame, but I think we can take some of that blame. I think there have been, you know, particularly with some of the minority populations in the United States, we've, you know, the experimentation. We had
well,
one of our guests on here months ago.
That makes me so sad.
And, you know, so there's a little bit of a distrust. But, you know, we're now in 2010 or 2011, and we've certainly got a lot of other tools here. So I think, yeah, it's sad. And there's also people's own responsibility to seek care when they start having symptoms. And I detect in our listener also some anger at their family members. So, yeah, I feel sad. And I understand also our listener feeling maybe a little bit angry or even frustrated with their own family. So there's a lot of dynamics here.
Well, and there's some people who really, for their own cultural beliefs or their own personal approach to life, don't want to know. And I think if you fully understand the risk you're taking, then that might be a decision that somebody wants to make, and that's okay. But sometimes I wonder if it's the mistrust of the medical system, or if it's other, or just not knowing the importance of early screening for cancer, if those are the things that make me sad.
Yeah, one of the things I often will tell patients is, and their family members and their spouses and children, is have conversations about these things.
Yeah.
Because you may not, it may not bother you, but it may bother, in this case, a daughter mm-hmm. or a granddaughter. You know, these things can last long past one family member passing away, too, and influence the next generation. So we want to make sure that everyone at least is on, at least shares their feelings with it. And thank you for sharing your feelings. What's our very next house call, Christy?
This one's about alternative supplements and high blood pressure.
What alternative supplements can you recommend for high blood pressure?
Oh, well, that's a very straightforward question.
Well, you know, but a straightforward question, but I don't know if the answer is straightforward.
I don't have a great answer.
You know, we did have a chance to look at some, you know, what are out there on some of the websites, and there's a whole bunch of things that are recommended, but I don't know really that the data really strongly suggests that these things are effective. Things like, you know, alpha-linolenic acid or omega-3 fatty acids.
Psyllium and calcium and cocoa. And
cod liver oil. Not that I've ever used that root for you, but
sounds gross.
This is in the literature. And, you know, for the most part, these things are probably safe in the types of doses that most people take them. But on the other hand, are they really effective? And we know that things like diet and exercise and smoking cessation and reducing salt, we know those are the cornerstones of the non-pharmacological management of high blood pressure.
I think if you really want to go, and if you're in the mild range and you want to go the non-medicine route for a while, then you work with those things of really working to lose weight and the things that Adam just talked about, particularly with the low salt diet and those things first. But I personally wouldn't waste your money on taking a bunch of supplements.
Some of which can have side effects like increasing the bleeding time and your propensity. And also, you know, we talked earlier in the show today, Christy, about meditation and mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And that's another technique that people can probably do safely, no side effects really, to maybe lower their blood pressure. So we would encourage the things that we know are safe that won't have side effects before things that may or may not be effective and still could have side effects.
Absolutely.
Well, what's our very last house call about sun? And boy, do we need some questions because it's hot out there.
Dr. Goldstein, my question is about protecting children from the sun. If you have an opinion about whether protective clothing is better than sunblock or if applying sunblock is adequate. Thanks.
This is a wonderful question, and it's near and dear to me this summer. My father died of melanoma, which is a type of skin cancer, when he was in his 40s. And so I'm trying so hard to protect my family, my children, from the sun so that they don't have the same thing happen to them.
Yeah. Actually, Christy, I'm going to ask you a real quick question. Do sunscreens labeled 15 and higher, do they protect you against all the sun's rays? What do you think? True or false? They protect you against all the sun's rays?
No.
No, they get that UVB, but not the UVA. And what do you think? Sunscreens should only be used on cloudy days? True or false?
False.
False again, yeah. See, Christy, you are right on target here. And exactly as you say, this question about sun protective clothing, it's a great question, and but it's not an either or, really. And actually, in Australia, they have this campaign, Christy, called Slip, Flap, and Flop.
I love it. Slip, flap,
that means
flop.
Slip your hat on, flap your shirt on, and then flop your sunscreen on. It's written in that order because it says that you should use the common things that protect you before the sunscreen where you think, oh, I can stay out longer in the sun. So sun protective clothing, anything actually that you wear on your clothing other than being naked will give you protection. But don't forget about the hat and the shirt and the sunscreen.
And avoiding those peak hours during the middle of the day when it's so hot. They make so many cool sun shirts and things for children. You can find them on the internet or at various stores. And they'll tell you about how well it protects from the sun. And I really recommend that we just all get used to wearing sun shirts and covering our children.
They're called the UPF, the Ultraviolet Protection Factor. We'll hear more about that as time goes on. But that's going to conclude our house call segment of our show today. We've been able to talk about B12 and acne.
A little bit about alternative supplements for blood pressure.
Getting into the doctor when you have symptoms early or even preventing those symptoms from ever starting. And then this last issue about sun protective clothing.
So thank you for joining us for your health. And we hope that we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. Thank you for those of you who've called us and written us. And we want those of you out there who haven't done it yet to send us a question. It's at yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can call us on the phone at
966-8091.
And you can also go
yourhealthradio.org. And we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Matt Morrow. Hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll see you again next week.
Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.